It's working. Okay. Today we are starting the new big topic in our course, and that's anomaly detection. We start with parametric methods of anomaly detection, statistical methods, and we are going to dedicate one lecture to that. Then we have non-parametric methods, and finally machine learning, that is also non-parametric, but we treat it as a separate subtopic. So we have just a short introduction about anomaly detection, and then we study these parametric anomaly detection methods. If you remember, we talked in our first lecture about what is anomaly detection. We said that it's a system that establishes profiles of normality. So what is normal user or network behavior? Then it compares the actual behavior to those profiles, and if any deviations are found, then we have an alarm. These profiles are defined as set of metrics or features which are measures of particular aspects of user or network behavior, like CPU time used, etc., etc. Then to each metric, we assign a threshold. So that's one possibility. Another possibility is a permitted range of values. For example, the number of files deleted in an hour has to be between 1 and 5, something like that. That would be a range. So we also said that anomaly detection depends on an assumption that everything is predictable, consistent, etc., etc., which is not realistic. Because of that, these systems have to adapt to changes in behavior over time. Otherwise, we shall have even more false positives than we really want. The problem with this is false positives. So it's difficult to define a rich enough set of metrics to express all normal behavior. Such number of measurements would be huge. That's impractical. We cannot do that. Because of that, we have to reduce the precision of what we measure, not the precision of measurement of each characteristic, of each feature, but the number of measurements must be reduced, which reduces the precision and consequently increases the number of false positives. Because it may happen, since our definitions of normality are not precise enough, that we do not match the normality. However, it will still normal be normal behavior, and it will be a false positive. Now, how annoying is false positives? It's actually very annoying and costly. So the best commercial misuse-based ideas achieve 5 to 1 to 20 to 1 ratio of false positives true positives, which means if we want one true positive, which means real attack, then we get 5 additional, in the best case, 5 additional false positives. And in the worst, 20. Now, anomaly detection is much worse than that. It may be thousands to one or something like that. So it's really bad. And here is a small example. If we install any IDS, it doesn't have to be anomaly detection, any IDS, misuse or anomaly, without fine-tuning upon installation, it will probably generate a lot of false positives. Suppose that this system sends to the operator 1,000 emails from the IDS per day, each email warning about 8 intrusions. That's 8,000 alarms from the IDS per day. Now, is it very large number? We shall see. A day, 24 hours, it has 86,400 seconds, which means that when we divide by 8,000, we get approximately 11 seconds to study each alarm. So if you want to engage one operator that would work 24 hours per day, not eating, not sleeping, not doing anything, just studying this, 11 seconds per one alarm. So that would be terrible. Of course, you cannot engage anybody to do that. So you need 3 operators in 8-hour shifts doing nothing else. So that's really unrealistic. Maybe probably 4, maybe 5. So it's not just anybody from the street. It has to be engineer, expert in security, etc., etc. That's costly. So you have to pay in 8-hour shifts. So after 2 weeks, approximately, all alarms from the IDS are just ignored because nobody can work such tedious job every day. So that's really impossible. So you have to reduce somehow the number of false positives. That's the only realistic solution. We separately treat in this course statistical methods and machine learning methods, and, well, we shouldn't actually do that because some say that machine learning is new statistics. It's just more variables involved. So what is the difference between statistics and machine learning? They are driven by the differences. Well, the difference between statistical anomaly detection methods and machine learning anomaly detection methods is driven by the differences between statistics and machine learning, if any. So the question arises, is there any difference between statistics and machine learning? There's no general answer. However, many relevant researchers say there is no difference between statistics and machine learning, at least no substantial difference. There are, of course, many opinions on this. The majority says these disciplines will converge in the future. So very often we call them data science or statistical machine learning, etc., etc. So today, if you want to define course in statistics, you will not name it statistics. You name it data science. Because otherwise the students will run away. They don't like mathematics, most of them. So current status of this discussion is that both fields want to learn from data. So there is no difference in this sense. So both statistics and machine learning, they learn from data. Many differences are there for historical reasons only, and they get less relevant as time passes because the technology advances, and before we couldn't do many things in statistics, normal statistics, what we call statistics, because after 2-3 variables it was not possible to handle all this, but today we can do it with computers, so that's no problem. So some say machine learning is a new statistics, because we can say that very often quoted difference, for example this one, is that with a lot of simplification, of course, we can say that statistics emphasizes formal statistical inference, like confidence intervals, hypothesis tests, optimal estimators in low-dimensional problems, so few variables. And machine learning emphasizes the same, but in high dimension. So high dimensional prediction problems. So most often we can talk about the difference between statistics and machine learning just by the dimension. Everything else is actually either the same or very similar. But that's just one branch. Some say that they are different, so it's not the only opinion on this. So we are going to treat them separately. Even though one can say why machine learning treated separately, we can treat it as statistical methods. So that's also possible. So back to the topic, actually, anomaly detection. Actually, these systems were the first to appear already in 1980s, of course, on mainframes and very specific military, Pentagon, etc., etc. So Dorothy Denning was the first to name these systems intrusion detection systems. So they were designed to be, at that time, very popular expert systems. So expert systems were designed to help humans in making decisions. So that was thought to solve all the problems of the mankind. Of course, it did not happen. Today we invest so much in machine learning, deep learning, but that's also statistics, so chances are that in a few years we get disappointed as well. We have to see. So the idea in the Denning's case, in the original paper, the first paper that you have in Blackboard, actually, you can read that paper, it was to use expert knowledge to define the metrics or features and thresholds or ranges, all permitted values for these metrics in order to characterize what is normal for computer users. For example, somebody logs in to a mainframe, then he or she accesses these files or reads newspapers, etc., something like that. So if somebody just logs in and tries immediately to delete some operating system files, that will be suspicious, of course. So that's also a statistical thing. The first intrusion detection systems were actually expert systems. So the first ever made was IDES, Intrusion Detection Expert System, by Denning, already in 1985, 1987, and updated later, et cetera, et cetera. And then NIDES, Next Generation Intrusion Detection Expert System, in 1995, this one actually included, among other things, the network analysis, because in between these two, internet has become popular and widely used, and other kinds of networks. So the role of these expert systems was to support in decision-making by the administrator or the operator of the monitored host or network. The statistical methods of anomaly detection can be divided in two categories, parametric and non-parametric, depending on whether we assume what is the underlying distribution of data or not. So if we make assumptions about the underlying distribution, then it's called a parametric method. If not, it's called non-parametric method, usually classification techniques, machine learning, clustering, etc., etc. So that's non-parametric. So we do not assume the distribution. And if we do assume, we usually assume that it's Gaussian, which is quite normal. That's why it's called normal distribution. However, it's not always true that the underlying distribution is normal. So let's start with the parametric analysis. Next week, we talk about non-parametric systems. So today, we focus on parametrics. And these were the first to be studied and the first practical systems that appeared, anomaly detection and intrusion detection in general, they were actually parametric systems. So, as we said, in most practical cases, the assumed distribution of events is Gaussian. And this doesn't hold in many cases with sufficient level of confidence. Often the actual distribution is not Gaussian. It was actually illustrated, for example, in the book by Bayes. You can read that. So that's our auxiliary literature for this course. So consequence, we get false positives. A wrong assumption about the distribution of events results in a large number of false positives. And if we want to determine the actual distribution, we do it by probabilistic means. So we do statistical testing, hypothesis testing, etc., etc. What's the underlying distribution? So if not Gaussian, it's difficult. So we get the result with certain probability. In non-parametric case, first proposed by this author in 1991, so if we don't want to determine the actual event distribution, or we cannot determine, or we are not satisfied with the probability of correctness of this result, of these tests, then we can use non-parametric analysis without actually assuming any distribution, typically cluster analysis. So we are going to dedicate some time to cluster analysis next week. So these are pattern recognition methods. Let's review some basic things from statistics. Of course, you know Gaussian distribution, so the normal probability density function is this, you know this. The normal probability distribution is actually integral from minus infinity to z, the probability that the random variable takes the value that is smaller than z. So that's the normal probability distribution. Now the mean, as usual, the standard deviation sigma is computed in two ways, so either this way or that way. That's the same. The standard normal distribution is N01, actually, but you can convert any normal distribution into N01 by using a substitution, x minus mu x divided by sigma x. So that's also very well known. If you forgot this, please read in any books from statistics, you find this. But you must have met that before. Now, Denning, in this first paper about intrusion detection, actually defined a model of intrusion detection. So it served as a basis for the first ever intrusion detection system, IDES, so Intrusion Detection Expert System. The basic assumption, of course, we said that in our first lecture, there is a difference in evidence of normal and abnormal system activities, and only that difference makes intrusion detection possible. The Denning's model does not depend on any particular IDS or any particular computer system or network. It was entirely implemented in IDES, and that was in 1987, so a long time ago when I was a student. Well, I just graduated. So the network traffic in that time did not have the same importance as it has today. There were mainframe computers maybe connected, but internet like we know it today did not exist. So all components of the model can be generalized, of course, to any computer system without limiting ourselves to hosts only and audit records, which mean logs on these hosts. We can include network, and it was actually done in NIDES. There are six main components of Denning's model: subjects, objects, audit records, profiles, anomaly records, and activity rules. So we are going to explain each of them. First, the subjects. These are those that initiate the activities on the monitor system. In most cases, they are users, but they can also be processes on a monitor system, like machine-to-machine communication, etc., etc. So we can consider machines as subjects, bearing in mind the current trends in machine-to-machine communication. So that's possible. But in the original model, this, of course, did not exist. So we talked about users. The subjects can be grouped into classes in order for processing to be more efficient. This classification depends on the concrete system, and overlap between classes is possible. For example, users and administrators. User can be an administrator as well. So that's a typical example of overlap. So that was the subjects. Then we have objects. By objects, we usually assume the resources that are accessed or managed by the subjects, like files, devices, some printers, etc., etc., but also networking resources. At that time, as I said, the networking resources were not studied, but we can, without any loss of generality, add network resources as possible objects. System commands can also be resources. When a subject is a target of an action initiated by another subject, for example, an email recipient, it is also considered an object. So even though it's a user, it is an object because another subject actually sends some information to this other user, which in that case is an object. In the same way as subjects, objects can also be grouped into classes. The next element is the audit records. Now, at the time the model was published, it was log files. So, and audit records contained in those files represented main source of information about activities, for example, file deleted, file created, some resource accessed, etc., etc. You find all this in logs, for example, of an operating system, but it can be an application as well. We can generalize this to non-host-based environments. The only condition is that there exists records of system activity. We may have logs on routers, on servers. We do have, actually. So we can include that as well. So I'm talking about a system that is almost 50 years old, but I'm including networking in this model because it can be done. And we need networking today because we almost certainly use networks in our everyday life. The format of these audit records includes these six elements: subjects, so who did, action, what did, object, to whom, then exception condition, what happened, resource usage, what was used as resources, and timestamp, when. The classical audit records explicitly identify the activities or events in most cases. For example, user login or file or device access. And so we have already said that regarding logs. So that's what you find in logs. so you will see who logged in, what was done logging in, on which system, for example, to which system somebody has logged in, what was wrong, started deleting files, for example, used 100% of CPU time, and when that happened, 23:59 in the night, for example. So that's really suspicious. It is possible to include non-explicitly identifying information to the set of audit records, and that's especially important with network traffic, because if we want that, then we have to identify the type of event by analyzing the traffic, and for example, what Zeek does. If you remember last week, we talked about Zeek, and we said it was HTTP request. Okay, so we can put that in log. And actually, you do have it in Zeek. The file http.log was created. That means that there was some HTTP traffic, and in this file, you find what was that a request, etc., or reply. Audit records could be collected from multiple hosts. Then we need an additional element that would be to identify the originating host. As a kind of modifier to the subject. So where the subject is coming from, which host. The audit records are presented in the model in a matrix form. The first dimension is the subject identifier. The second dimension is the object identifier. And the corresponding entry in the matrix is the audit record. The statistical metric values computed to determine whether a recorded event is considered normal or not is computed based on the audit records contained in this matrix. So you can, for example, count them. If it is guessing password 100 times, that's suspicious. Here is an example on the slide 30. We have subjects and objects. So subjects, subject 1, subject 2, subject I, for example, myself. Okay, so what have I done? I have communicated with some object J, and that's the root. So event IJ is the session open for user root by myself, my identifier. Which means I have logged in as root. So this is how audit records can be represented, and they are represented in the Dennings model this way. If an event involves multiple objects, which is also possible, then the model decomposes this multiple object structure into several single object events, which enables determining if an attack was attempted and succeeded or not. So somebody has attempted, but it doesn't mean that he or she has succeeded. How can we do that? The composition of the action per object relates the object to access rights and protection algorithms. For example, you can have access to one part of that action, but not to another one, so your attack will not be successful. An example is the move command. So say, move the file test.log, test1.log, to a directory at the same level but in another branch. So it's this part. So if you look at the audit records, for example, on some Linux distribution, you get this. Time, when, okay? Then the name of the file. The name type, create. The name, the name. The name type, first, delete. First create, and then delete, okay? Because it's move. And then which system call for this? It's system call 82 on this system. Success, yes. Exit, zero. And the command is move. This is the command where this move is. User bin MV. So this is what you get in the audit record for this move command. So that's two actions. So the Dennings model would actually decompose it into the creation part and the deletion part. So it would say, user, that one created the file. And then another event, user deleted the file. So the file is first created on the parent directory and then deleted on the original directory, as we can see from this. The action move files involves two objects, the created file and the deleted file. The system call exited with success. And that's a legal action performed by the user. The system call could say success is no, and then it would be maybe created but not deleted, but it would definitely not be deleted. That's important. Then we have timing. That is an important issue in anomaly detection. Sometimes we cannot wait for the action to complete in order to determine whether it was malicious or not. And why is that? Because if it is malicious, then if completed, then the attack is successful, obviously. Timestamps that are in these audit records can help in determining whether the record was collected in the beginning of the activity or after the activity was completed. And this depends on the logging system and consequently on the operating system running on the monitored host. If the information contained in the original audit record, for example log, is not sufficient for anomaly detection, then the model allows for additional collection of time information, whether it is collected at the beginning of the session or at the end of the action, for example, and it can be done by the anomaly detection system, not the operating system. So if the operating system doesn't provide for enough data for anomaly detection, then the very anomaly detector can do this timestamping. The next element of the Denning's model is profiles. These are actually the most essential components of an anomaly-based IDS. It's actually what is normal. Okay, so you define what is normal. It's crucial for its effectiveness. We describe normal behavior of the subjects regarding the objects. So we provide various statistical metrics and models of activities of the subjects related to the objects, which were recorded and analyzed in the past. So the system learns. In the model, it is considered that the profiles of normal behavior are automatically generated. Well, we don't have to do it this way. We can include expert, and we get expert knowledge. We pay some expert to tell us whether this pattern of activity is normal or not. The normal behavior is characterized because, remember, this is a statistical method. The normal behavior is characterized in terms of statistical metrics and statistical models. We are going to see what is a metric and what is a model. So first, metrics. What is a statistical metric? It's, well, since a metric, it's a random variable that represents values measured over a predefined period of time. For example, in an hour, if it is fixed or variable. For example, it can be the time elapsed between two events. For example, between logging in and logging out of a session. And that's recorded in a log file. Now, we combine these statistical metrics with statistical models to decide whether an observed event is normal or not. The Denning's model uses three types of metrics. It's the event counter, the interval timer, and the resource measure. Each audit record represents an event, so we can count these events, and this will be event counter. So the event counter counts events that have some features in common. For example, the number of wrong passwords typed in a predefined period of time, where the common feature is that the password is wrong. So we count something that has to do with other events of this kind. So that's the first statistical metric. So it's event type of statistical metric. It's event counter. The next one is interval timer. It's the time elapsed between two events that are mutually related. For example, it's the duration of a session. So between the logging in and logging out, that's interval timer. we compute the difference between the corresponding timestamps. That's easy. Finally, we have resource measure. For example, CPU time consumption, memory usage, network usage, etc. So that's the amount of resources used during some activity as recorded in the audit records. So these were statistical metrics. So we have event counters, we have internal timers, and we have resource measures. Then we have models, statistical models. So what we have is, well, we do some measurements, x1, x2, etc., until xn, and we get some results, and that's the random variable x that we are sampling. So we sample some random variable value. So a statistical model determines whether the next measurement taken after xn, say xn plus 1, is normal or abnormal. How do we decide whether it is normal or abnormal? That depends on the statistical model. It can be in the Dennings model of intrusion detection, 5 statistical models, operational model, mean and standard deviation model, multivariate model, Markov process model, and the time series model. So you see 5 statistical models that can be used. What's the difference between various models is in the way how or if at all they use the previous measurements of the same metric or several metrics. In the statistical metrics, to which they can be applied. So not all the models can be applied on all metrics, as we are going to see. So for each model, we shall say it's applicable on, for example, counting. You see, the, for example, applicable to event counters or interval timers or resource measures, etc., or some combination. So let's see these 5 statistical models. So the first one is easy. It's operational model, which does not use the previous measurements at all. So no matter what you did before, you just concentrate on the current measurements. You say you have the operational assumption that the new measurement of a metric X can be classified, which means determine whether it is normal or bad, only by comparing with the fixed limits known in advance, usually by experience, not by some statistics that can be measurable. So by experience, say more than 3 passwords get wrongly, that's something suspicious, by experience. So for example, an event counter of wrong password guesses in a determined short period of time can be considered malicious if it overcomes a value, say 30, 20, 3, whatever, obtained by experience. The values of these limits for the metric can also be obtained by using previous measurements, but on only the ones immediately preceding the current measurements, unlike, for example, some other models. So we say that maybe we based these decisions on experience, but this was measured, but not immediately preceding this particular measurement. Maybe last year or several years, or measured in some other systems or by others. So that's operational model. Now, mean and standard deviation, that is based actually on previous measurements, so immediately preceding the current measurement. So we have had measurements of some random variable sampling, x1, x2 to xn, and we measure xn plus 1 and want to decide whether it is good or bad. If xn plus 1 is outside of the confidence interval x minus mu, that is smaller than some number of sigmas of standard deviations, usually 3, smaller than 3 sigmas, then we assume that this is abnormal. So the confidence interval is up to 3 sigmas usually, and then if our measurement goes outside of that, then we say it's not good. Now we are talking about parametric systems, then the distribution is known. And we can compute exact probability that the random variable x takes a value that is inside the confidence interval. But What we can do is do the same, but even without knowing the distribution. We are going to talk about that. But for now, assume that we have normal distribution. So this is our assumption, and we have parameters, 0, 1. So mu is 0, sigma is 1. So that's the usual case. Now, if we take d equal to 3, so 3 sigmas plus minus of the measurement, that's the usual value, actually, 3 sigmas. Then the probability that x takes a value inside the confidence interval is, this is taken from the table of n01, it's 0.9774. You see? So phi of 3 is this value, and phi of minus 3 is this value. This is the distribution. This is found in tables. So that's the probability that x takes a value inside the confidence interval. So very high probability, actually. Now, if we do not know the distribution, we can still do something. So we can do the same calculation without assuming the distribution of x. We can use Chebyshev's inequality, and you find this in the Denning's paper as well. If you read the paper, you find this. So we estimate the probability that x takes a value which is outside of the confidence interval by means of this Chebyshev's inequality. So the probability that x minus mu is greater than or equal to some value epsilon is smaller than or equal to sigma squared divided by epsilon squared. Now, if you say that epsilon is d sigma, then the probability that x minus mu is greater than d sigma, which means that it is abnormal, is smaller than 1 divided by d squared. For d equal to 3, which is usually assumed, then we have the probability that the measurement is abnormal is smaller than or equal to 1 divided by 9, which is 0.11. So the probability that the measurement x n plus 1 of the random variable x of any distribution falls inside the confidence interval is, of course, 1 minus this. It's 1 minus 0.11, which is 0.89. So even if you do not know the distribution, you can still say something about the probability that your measurement actually falls inside the normality. So it's this one. If you assume that you go up to 3 sigmas. The metrics to which the mean and standard deviation model can be applied are all. So event counters, interval timers, and resource metrics, no matter which one, you can always use this. Because you can compute the mean and the standard deviation without knowing the distribution. The mean and the standard deviation are actually parameters of many distributions, actually almost all. So that's actually what you need, and then if you know the distribution, then you actually substitute the mu and sigma in this distribution. For example, we can use the mean and standard deviation model on the CPU time usage in a fixed amount of time. So this is a resource metric. So that's resource metric. Okay, so how much CPU time we use. So if the mean is 50%, the standard deviation is 3%, and the assumed distribution is Gaussian, then we have for d equal to 3 this probability that x is between mean minus 3 sigmas and mean plus 3 sigmas. It's the distribution function of this minus the distribution function of that. So mean plus 3 sigmas, mean minus 3 sigmas. Now, we have to substitute to get it from the tables, 0, 1. So you see, we can always say that zx is x minus mu divided by sigma, and then we can use the table n of 0, 1. You know that from secondary school. So you substitute that, so x minus mu divided by sigma, you see. So this is what you have to put in the table of n01, because this one is not n01. So it's 0.5, 0.03. It's not the same. Now, to use the table for N01, you have to substitute. You have to substitute the variable x with the variable z, that is x minus mu divided by sigma. And then you get these phis easily from the table N01. And that will be 0.9774 as expected, because it's Gaussian, you see, and it's three sigmas. So no matter what is mu and what is sigma, it's always this, whatever you do. So that's the probability, if you know the distribution. So knowing the distribution is an advantage, if you are sure, certain about that the distribution is normal. So what are the advantages of the mean and standard deviation model over the operational model? If we set a window of n previous observations of the metric x, to which the random variable x is assigned, then the IDS learns the behavior of the monitor system over time and adjusts its decisions to the changes in that behavior. So you move the window and these values may change, and you may say that your normality is now different after a certain time, something that you cannot do with operational model, because in the operational model, what you compare with is fixed forever. Doesn't depend on the immediately preceding measurements. We can also introduce weights that would give preference to more recent results of the measurements if we want that. That's also possible. And then we can set a different confidence interval. It doesn't have to be three sigmas. We can say we can be stricter. We can say two sigmas, etc., etc. So we can do it differently for each different user of a system. So somebody needs three sigmas, somebody needs one sigma, somebody needs four sigmas. And we can vary that. So that was the mean and the standard deviation model. The third model is the multivariate model, which takes into account correlation between metrics. So previously we have studied metrics separately. We didn't consider the relation, eventual relationship between the metrics. So these relations can be included in the overall score by means of a correlation matrix. For example, there may be correlation between the consumed CPU time in the predefined time interval and the memory usage in the same interval. You can imagine that's quite common, actually, that you not only use more CPU in the case of some activity, but also more memory if the process is resource-consuming, let's say. So this gives more information to the operator in the decision-making process than each of these measures taken separately. The correlation between the metrics must be determined precisely and reliably, because it may vary. So it can change over time, and because of that it has to be updated. Otherwise we get what? False positives, and that's what we don't want. The multivariate model can be applied on the same metrics as the mean and the standard deviation model, which means everything: event counters, interval timers, and resource metrics. To compute correlation between two or more variables, we need covariance. And we suppose that observations give us joint probabilities of the considered events. So the probability that the CPU consumption is this and the memory consumption is that. So and is the key word here. So that's joint probability. And we start from these probabilities, compute marginal probabilities of the events, the means, standard deviations, and subsequently the covariance, and after that the correlation is automatically computed. You are going to see this, but after the break. We are continuing our discussion of statistical models in the Denning's IDS model. We started talking about the multivariate model. So there are possibilities here, so to study related or correlated variables. And here is an example. Two event counter variables, the number of root logins to the monitor system per minute, for example, and the number of times the file root-only.txt is accessed per minute. Possible values, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and of course we are talking about discrete random variables because you cannot have 1.3 logins, so it's discrete process. Okay? So we have registered the numbers of root logins, which is the random variable X, and the numbers of times the file root-only.txt has been accessed, the random variable Y, over a long period of time, and we obtained the joint probabilities P of XY of the values for X and Y. And it's tabulated here. So the variable X is the number of root logins, and the variable Y is the number of accesses to that file. So you have the probability that in some period of time you have per minute, we said. So you have one root login and one access to that file is 0.01. If you have one root login and two accesses, 0.01. One root login and three accesses, 0.02. You now understand what I mean by these joint probabilities. Yeah? So for each possible pairs of values, we have the joint probabilities. Now, we have to compute the correlation between X and Y, if any. So if the correlation is zero, then it's zero. No correlation. Now let's see from these probabilities here. We have to compute the marginal probability. So P of X is sum for each Y of P of X, Y. Okay? So for each fixed X, okay, for each fixed Y, sorry, for each fixed Y, we sum the row here. Okay, so we get the marginal probability here. And, of course, P of Y is overall X is P of X, Y. So we fix X and then you sum per column. And you get this. So P of Y is sum over X's, and P of X is sum over Y's, as we said. So P of X is sum over Y's, and P of Y is sum over X's. Okay, now, of course, this sum of all the marginal probabilities must be 1, and the sum of all these marginal probabilities must be 1. Now, in our case, of course, it's true. The mean for the number of root logins is taken over all x's, xp of x. So these are marginal probabilities now. So p of x is 0.06 times 1 plus 0.35 times 2, etc., etc. So what we get is mu x is 3. So the mean for the number of root logins is the random variable X is 3 root logins per minute. And the variance sigma square is X minus mu X square times P of X over all X's, this sum, so we get 1.38. So that's for X's. Now for Y's the same. So mu Y is sum over Y's, Y times P of Y, so we get 2.9 accesses to root-only.txt. Of course, these can be decimal numbers because this is not the value of the variable. And the variance is this, by the same formula, 229. Now, we have to compute the covariance. Covariance is mu xy minus mu x mu y. So we have computed mu x and mu y. So we have to compute mu xy. And mu xy is this. So over x, all x and y's, x times y times p of x, y, which means take each value in this table except of marginal probabilities. So P of x, y is this, and then times x times y, and then times x times y, this P of x, y, etc., etc., so until we cover the whole table. And then minus mu x, mu y, we have computed that, mu x is 3 and mu y is 2.9. So we get minus 0.14. This can be negative. And the correlation can be also negative. So it's sigma xy divided by sigma x, sigma y. We have computed sigma x and sigma y, and we have computed sigma xy. So it's here. So what we get is minus 0.08. So there is a negative correlation. So x increases, y decreases. So it's negative correlation. It is possible to compute pairwise correlation coefficients between the variables involved in determining the status of the monitor system if you have more than two. For example, if we consider CPU usage, memory usage, and network usage, three typical measurements, we can compute pairwise correlation coefficients between these variables. So CPU usage, memory usage, CPU usage, network usage, memory usage, network usage. So these are pairwise correlation coefficients the same way as in this example. So we need these joint probabilities and the possible values. And of course, this is not discrete. It's continuous variable because these can be any value between 0 and 1. Thus, we obtain 3 times 3 correlation matrix that can be used in determining the overall score for anomaly detection. In case of continuous variables, we have integrals instead of sums. So that was the multivariate model, very often used actually, and you will see that in IDES they used it. Then we have the Markov process model, which takes into account the transition probabilities between the states of the monitor system. The states are defined by the types of records from the audit logs. For example, each record type determines a state. Example states, and this model applies to event counters only. So log in as root, how many times, delete a file, how many times, copy a file, how many times. So that's event counter. Transition frequencies between states observed in a relatively long time period define the transition probabilities. And these transition probabilities give more information to the operator than each of them taken separately. Example, the probability that the file is deleted if the user is logged in as root. It's more informative than just the probability of deleting a file. In the Markov process, it is assumed that the next state depends only on the immediately preceding state and the transition probability determined in advance. And that's a process that is called homogeneous in time. A new observation, x n plus 1, is considered abnormal if its probability, which is determined by the preceding state slash observation and the transition probability, is too low. So it's quite unlikely that this action comes up from this state. Now, Denning's model uses Markov processes in a very rudimentary way. The system only compares the transition probabilities determined for the current unit of time with the same transition probabilities determined previously. We actually compare two matrices. So from these probabilities, the system determines whether the transition is normal or abnormal, which means too low transition probability. We don't try to predict the next state. So in Markov process analysis, you can do many things. But in the Denning's model, they are not used. So we are not trying to predict the next state of the system given the previous state and the transition probabilities. We just want to assess the matrix that is taken recently, from recent measurements, with the matrix that is taken over a long period of time. Let's illustrate this on an example. Many things will be much clearer in that case. So suppose that we have three event counters, number of logins as root per hour, number of file deletions per hour, and number of file copying operations per hour. Okay? Now, consequently, the states are login as root, that's state S1, file deletion, that's state S2, and file copying, that's state S3. You see, each action is actually defining a state. The transition probabilities are determined by counting the numbers of state transitions during a relatively long period of time, and then we compare that with the transition probabilities obtained in the current period of time, say last hour. For example, a long-term transition probabilities are given in the form of the transition matrix, call it P. So we have S1 was logging as root, S2 deletion, and S3 copying. So you log in as root and then log in as root again. That's possible, you open a shell. Log in as root and then you delete a file. Log in as root and then you copy a file, etc., etc. So you can imagine what possibilities are here. So here on the slide 77, you have the probability of deleting files if logged in as root is 0.4. That's this value. So you log in as root and then you delete a file. The transition matrix obviously is not symmetric with respect to the main diagonal. So you cannot, there is no symmetry. The raw sums are all equal to 1. So you log in as root, you can do three things, and the sum of the probabilities must be 1. 0.1 plus 0.4 plus 0.5 is 1, etc., etc. It's always 1 per row, but not per column. So the column sums of the matrix are not required to be equal to 1. Now, you have the long-term transition matrix P, and now in the last hour we do the same. We count how many times after logging as root somebody has opened the shell, root shell. So that's in the last hour. So we get the transition matrix P prime. And we actually compare this matrix to the long-term transition matrix P. If some probabilities in the matrix P prime are much smaller than the corresponding transition probabilities from the matrix P, then it's wrong, so it's abnormal. So that was the Markov process model. We are going to see that in the exercise. Some examples. Finally, we have the time series model. It's not only about the measurements, it's about when they happen. So this model takes into account the order of appearance and time instance of the measurements, x1 to xn, and the values of these measurements. So not only the values, but also whether they come in the proper order. So the measurements xn plus 1 is considered abnormal if its probability of occurring at a particular time is low compared to the previous occurrences. So this is interesting. It applies to everything. It applies to internal timers, event counters, and resource measures. So we have seen so far that only the Markov process actually only applies to counters. Now, the time series model, let's consider an example. The number of file deletions between two subsequent logins as root. For determining the time between the two subsequent logins as root, we have an interval timer. For counting the number of deletions, we have an event counter. So too many deletions between these two subsequent logins as root will have a low probability of occurrence. So that's abnormal. So if somebody logs in as root and then deletes 50 files in 1 second, that's abnormal. The advantage, of course, is that it is possible to measure trends in behavior over time, so how many times between two logins you delete how many files. So this may vary. We can detect gradual but significant trends in behavior by this method, this model. The disadvantage is that it's costly. So it's more complex than the mean and standard deviation model, but if you want to sacrifice some money, means CPU time, resources, then it pays. So that was the model. Then what do we have in this event activity profile? So we have now learned that we have the metric, we have the statistical model, and we have the set of audit events. Okay? So these two things we have already discussed. The set of audit events is what we have measured. So we have 7 subjects and object independent components and 3 subject and object dependent components of an activity profile. The subjects and object independent components are the name of the variable, the action, the exception, what's wrong, the resource usage, the period, the variable type, and the threshold. So we are going to discuss that. And the dependent components are subjects, object, and value. Well, the very subject, the very object, they must be subject and object dependent components, and the value is also. So if you look at the logs, the intersection between the subject and object, that's also subject and object dependent component in that matrix. So, what is the action? Now we are studying each of these components separately. So it's variable name, action. Well, name is not much to discuss. You give it the name that you want. Now, what is the action? It can be login, it can be execute a program, it can be delete a file, etc., etc. The time interval may be a day, maybe an hour, maybe null if the period is equal to the duration of the activity. Then the variable type, which one? It may be event counter, it may be resource metric, etc., etc. The threshold, we provide the limits that we use to detect abnormality because it's always, we never store a database of normality. That would be a huge database. So because of that, we just define this threshold and ranges if necessary. Then these limits are determined by the statistical model. For example, for the operational model, we have the lower and the upper bound of the value of the measurement. For example, the number of wrong passwords guessing can be between 0 and 30. And for the mean and the standard deviation model, the number D of standard deviations from the mean. This can vary per user. The value is the most recent measurement of the variable. Now, when an IDS processes an audit record, for example, this is a line in a log file, that's one audit record, it updates the distribution of the corresponding variable, for example, the number of file deletions, because in the record it says file deleted. Then if IDS reads that, it increases the number of file deletions, the variable. And then we check for abnormality. We compare this variable, the value, with the threshold. So by updating the distribution of the variables, the system actually learns. So we just set the time window, and then we move the time window. And within this time window, we have things constant. But then we update this, and when we next time move the window, we have learned something. Then we have anomaly records. Now, they contain information about anomalous behavior in the monitor system, so these are alerts. Why do we need to store them? Because we may analyze that in the future. And then, if necessary, we can, based on this analysis, modify the profiles of normal behavior, because these alerts may be false because the user has adapted to, etc., etc. So the user behavior has changed. The consequence is that if we don't adapt, we shall have more false positives. An anomaly record consists of 3 components. An event identifier. It's abnormal because a data item from an audit record has been found to be abnormal. For example, label is audit. Or abnormal because data accumulated over a time period have been found to be abnormal. The label is period. So this event identifier may be either audit or period. Then we have So why the event is abnormal? Then we have the timestamp, when it happened, and then the corresponding profile identified that triggered the alert event. So that's what we have here. This record is there. Then we have activity rules in this Stennings model that, based on anomaly records and other data produced during operation of the intrusion detection, it is possible to activate specific actions if certain conditions are met, like blocking the traffic, what we did in the IPS. So we have an intrusion prevention system. This is not real time because these systems inherently process batch, because it's statistics. So you need some history. You have to collect the data, and then you analyze the data and produce output. Although, if this is fast, then we get close to real-time operation. It depends on how much data we have to process at the time. In addition to performing predefined actions if certain conditions are met, these activity rules also generate reports on anomalies detected in the period defined in advance. And we can use specific rules for that. There are four types of rules. We have audit record rules, periodic activity update rules, anomaly record rules, and periodic anomaly analysis rules. The audit record rules are generated when a new audit record matches an activity profile. So this does not mean anomalous behavior. We just provide information that some match happened. Then we have these periodic activity update rules. They are activated at the end of predefined specific intervals defined in the profile, so like 1 hour, 1 day, etc., etc. Then we have anomaly record rules that are triggered by anomalies detected, a typical IDS. So that's actually an IDS. So these anomaly record rules that are triggered by anomalies that are detected at the time they are detected. And finally, periodic anomaly analysis rules triggered at the end of a predefined interval. How many abnormalities have we had? Is this something that requires more attention and maybe hardening our system, etc., etc.? We finalized today's talk by providing two examples of where this model has been implemented in its entirety. So the first one is IDES, Intrusion Detection Expert Systems, finalized in 1991, so it was started and reported about in 1985, 1987, etc., etc., but it was finalized in 1991. It's a military system, so the client was Space Warfare System Command by U.S. Navy. Now, it's full implementation of the Dennings model. The output is the IDES score. It's a scalar value, just a single number, characterizing the state of the security of the monitor system. So you can monitor the value, this, during the time, so you can get some over some threshold and you say that's an alarm, etc., etc. Now, the IDES score, it's a number, but it's a summary of many measurements, and these measurements are called S-statistics. You have the original paper in Blackboard. You can read it. It's very interesting. So many details about what was measured, etc. So you have many measurements, these S-statistics of abnormality. Then pairwise correlation between S-statistics was taken into account. Say you have two measurements, SI and SJ, and the correlation between them is CIJ. Okay? So it's N times N correlation matrix. If you have N these measurements, so then CII is always 1 for I equal from 1 to N. So it's symmetric on the main diagonal. The IDES score is, you see, this is a vector. S1, Sn, that's one vector, times inverted correlation matrix, times the same vector, S1 to Sn transpose. Now, the result of this is a scalar. The measurements are not direct, so they are computed actually from the direct measurements, QI, in some heuristic way. Heuristic is by experience. So the heuristic takes into account the distribution of QI, real measurements, for example, CPU time, that's Q, and assigns a weight to each measurement that corresponds to the category of values to which the measurement belongs. Less likely categories are assigned greater positive weights. We can also take into account the time of measurements. So it's a kind of weight adapting to the behavior. So the measurements that are more recent may have more weight. Or the other way around. It depends what you want. There exist separate heuristics for computing the S statistics from the Q statistics for ordinal and categorical measurements. So that was IDES. So IDES score, we are going to exercise that, how to compute this. So you will have to recall how we invert matrices, of course, of low dimension, Gaussian algorithm. Now, NIDES is Next Generation Intrusion Detection Expert System. It was finished or finalized in 1995. It included some networking. So it's also full implementation of the Dennings model. The output is the NIDES score called T-square. It's a Scala value, but we do not take correlation into account directly. So it's easier to compute, but we do not take correlation into account directly. So the NIDES score is similar to the IDES score. It's a summary of many measurements, these S statistics of abnormality. We do not have pairwise statistics. Then the IDES score is reduced to the sum of squares of SI. So that's exactly that. Just the difference is that we just divide by N. We are going to have an example on this in our exercise. You will see that it's, that's the only difference if there is no correlation. So T square is 1 divided by N times the sum 1 to N of SI squared. These SIs are obtained from QIs, the same as in IDES. And we can set an upper threshold for the NIDES score T square. If we exceed the threshold, then we get an alert to the operator. NIDES also has a misused Bayes intrusion detection component, which is used to detect known attacks by means of signatures. It also includes the network analysis component, that's network-based intrusion detection. So that's its ambition was also some misuse detection and network analysis. Now, both IDES and NIDES, they are scalars, so they are single number, influenced by many metrics. Now, if you have that this value has overcome the threshold, it's not possible to judge on the original metrics on the basis of just this score. So you need further investigation why you get this value over the threshold. And it's usually manual analysis, maybe computer-assisted, but the decision is on the human operator, whether it is a panic or not. Now, to finalize today's discussion, what are the advantages of parametric methods? We do not need to maintain a large knowledge base for the IDES. We can adapt profiles. We allow learning of the system behavior over time and adapting to changes. It is fast. We don't have search for indicators of abnormality. We only have numerical computation based on historical data. With today's computing technology, this is very, very fast. Disadvantages, it's not real time. It's batch processing. We can get close to the real time analysis if we do it very fast on small amount of data, but if we need large history, then it will not be necessarily slow. Necessarily fast, sorry. Now, because of that, we cannot immediately block traffic, so no real-time IPS is possible. But we can have a delay that is relatively small if our system is good enough. Now, the worst of all is that it is difficult to set up this system. It's difficult to set appropriate thresholds. Consequence is high false positive rate if the thresholds are too low. High false negative rate if the thresholds are too high. So we have to update these thresholds over time to adapt to the changes in system behavior. So this is all time-consuming, requires human intervention, and it's tedious. Well, that's all for today. Tomorrow we exercise Zeek. Last time we said, recall, I gave you the homework to install Zeek. It's very easy to install, but it takes 2 hours. Because of that, do it, and tomorrow we have 4 examples where we demonstrate the scripting language of Zeek and how it can be configured to be misuse detector, anomaly detector, and much more. Okay, see you tomorrow in the exercise.